I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. At one level, nothing has changed. There's been a numbing series of recent reports of American soldiers killed in Iraq, still the roadside bombs, still the encounters with insurgents. Then this morning, another in a year-long sequence of explosions once again rocks the capital city, Baghdad. Once again, it's a car bomb. Once again, Iraqis are killed, 10, 12, perhaps more, and dozens injured. It is all reason enough to say that this so-called transfer of sovereignty has failed, that the interim Iraqi leadership is just as powerless to stop the insurgents as the American military was. But that might oversimplify the story. In recent days, the interim Iraqi government says it has worked to split the insurgents, to isolate the foreign fighters, the jihadis, and to offer a form of amnesty to Iraqis who carried arms in recent months. Despite the news, there are some indications that ordinary Iraqis are ready to listen. They will note, for example, the man touring the scene of today's car bomb was Iraq's interim Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi.
We will bring the criminals to justice. We think and believe this is in response to the recent arrests in the last two days, where we have captured some prominent criminals. We are going forward in building democracy, peace and stability in Iraq, and we like and call upon the international community to keep and continue their support to Iraq. And together we will defeat evil forces and bring them to justice.
But nothing yet has been accomplished. Despite the promises and the strong words, Alawi and his own people have yet to convince Iraqis that they have the power they claim. So what are your thoughts? Can these appointed Iraqi leaders steer the country from chaos and confusion? Can they make that distinction between insurgents who are fighting America and those who are fighting the idea of an independent or a democratic Iraq? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We start today with Peter Gresty. He is Baghdad correspondent for the BBC, and earlier today he was just 50 yards from the vehicle when it blew up. He's joining us now from Baghdad. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
How are you?
A little bit rattled, but otherwise fine. Can't say the same, unfortunately, for an awful lot of people that were around us. We were at the head of a queue about to go into the green zone, the fortified compound that surrounds the interim Iraqi government, when the explosion went off, and it really ripped through the crowd that was lining up, queuing up outside the checkpoint in something of a traffic jam.
Mind me, what do you recall from the bomb itself? Did it knock you down?
We were just inside the vehicle, and that probably was what protected us. The force of the blast thumped the car quite hard. I was absolutely shocked to hear it, as you can imagine. There was a huge wave of cries and screams as the bits of shrapnel rained down on the car around us. Our car itself was partly bent in by the force of the explosion, although we didn't receive any bits of shrapnel. We raced inside. There was a lot of shooting going on as the local Iraqi police forces tried to calm the crowd, tried to get some kind of order back in control of things. And then the American forces came. They sealed off the area with tanks at either end and had helicopters moving overhead. There was a tremendously tense period immediately after, as you can imagine. No one really knew quite what was going on, whether there were going to be secondary explosions and so on. And then once the situation had calmed, we realized that it was, in fact, a suicide car bomber that had struck the queue.
Now, Peter, the 14th of July is a holiday in Iraq. It marks the end of the monarchy. If I'm not mistaken, there's even a bridge named 14th of July Bridge there. Was something expected on this day?
Not really. I think a lot of people have been expecting something of some sort for quite some time. There has been a steady series of attacks. No car bombs like this directed at the Green Zone so far, but a lot of us have been expecting something from the insurgency. I don't think that there were too many people that may have pinpointed this particular day, but clearly I think it comes as a sharp reminder that the insurgency is still very active, still eminently capable of striking targets at will here.
And does anybody really know what the target of this particular vehicle bomb was? Because the Green Zone that you refer to is now home to both, I think, the American embassy, but also this interim Iraqi government. Who was being targeted?
I don't think we can say that any individual specifically was targeted. It may have been a generalized punch or lash out at the government itself or the Americans or the British or anyone indeed who was cooperating with them. And I think really those were the people that were the victims here. It was ordinary office workers and visitors that had business with the interim administration, including ourselves. There were a lot of journalists in that particular queue that were lining up to go in for a press conference. So I suspect that it was more a signal to people not to have anything to do with the administration. Of course, Iyad Alawi himself said that he believes that they were criminals that were responsible for this, that were lashing out in response to the police operation, which has cracked down on organized crime across the city over the past day. But frankly, I suspect that may not be the case. I find it hard to see that a suicide bomber would give up his life for the sake of a crime gang. It seems to be something that an ideologue would do. But clearly, I think the authorities are investigating all the angles at the moment.
And Peter, I know you have other stories to file, so a quick last question for you, though. When Iraqis get all the details of this particular vehicle bomb and find out that it was largely Iraqis who were killed by it, is it possible that it could have the reverse effect and provide some kind of citizen boost for the interim government, a further desire to use anybody who claims to have power at this time to further crack down on the insurgents?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it's one that we've all been asking ourselves for quite some time. Clearly, there is a lot of revulsion on the streets directed at the people that they say are the foreign fighters, the foreign terrorists that are causing a lot of these explosions. But equally, a lot of the anger is still directed at the US and British forces, at the coalition forces that were responsible for this. In fact, earlier today, we were just out talking to quite a number of people about whether they felt that on balance, this whole conflict, the war itself, may have been for the better, that it was worth it to have Saddam Hussein overthrown. And time and again, I have to say that a lot of people kept telling us that although they were delighted to see Saddam Hussein gone, they had no love, there was really no thanks to the British and American forces if this was the consequence of it. So I think I'm not sure that the interim government will be able to reap any kind of strange dividend out of this. Mm-hmm. And I think people really are still bitterly angry with both the American administration and the British, and also the people that they describe as the foreign fighters here.
Peter, it's good of you to spend a few moments with us. I'm delighted that you are still on your feet.
Thank you very much.
Peter Gresty is Baghdad correspondent for the BBC. He was just a short distance away from the car bomb when it blew up earlier this morning in the capital of Iraq. The latest details are that 10, perhaps 12 people were killed in that blast. Certainly dozens more were injured. In this hour on the program, we're talking about whether or not the transfer of power to the interim Iraqi government is going to be seen either by people there or anyone anywhere in the world as an effective switch. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're joined now by Dan Murphy. He is Baghdad correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and Dan has been following this handover of power in Iraq. He's joining us on the phone from Baghdad. Hello, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, this confidence in Alawi, what are you hearing when you talk to people about whether or not they're willing to say, yeah, go get the insurgents?
They're absolutely behind anybody that can demonstrate they're capable of getting the insurgents and, more importantly, getting after the criminals that have plagued thousands of average Iraqis during the occupation. And they look at Alawi with a great deal of skepticism as a former source for the CIA and as a longtime exile, which doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't willing to give him credit for doing a good job, but their attitude is show me. And the fact of life is for many Iraqis that little has changed so far. And so what initial goodwill he has is probably going to dissipate quickly if there aren't fast improvements.
Help me with what you have actually seen on the ground there about what we have heard reported. There have been stories that this interim administration of Alawis has been rounding up insurgents, actually, you know, using its own contacts and its own intelligence to get some of the leaders. What do we know about that?
Very little. What's been visible has been a very heavily coordinated plan that's been at least 2 months in the making to go after criminal gangs that have flourished since the fall of Baghdad last spring. The day that they took power on the 28th, they swept through a sort of tough market neighborhood where a lot of criminals do live, arrested about 150, 160 people, publicly beat them on the streets. dragged them off to cells, held them all for 2-3 days, ended up letting about 100 of them go, and kept 50 of them after they said those 50 men had confessed to crimes. Now, there have been some claims that some of these men that have been rounded up in these sweeps against common criminals have also had ties to the insurgency, but there's certainly no evidence so far that they've gotten any big fish. And in fact, I believe, as your intro to this mentioned, Alawi is really looking at trying to negotiate with insurgents now, craft some kind of amnesty program that will bring them into a big tent, but there's no details available on that yet.
So any idea then, Dan, how much of it is talk at this point? How much of it is real action?
Well, in terms of any sort of amnesty plan, the problem is that they've sort of gone on record as saying that people that have committed major crimes of killings or terrorist attacks or even large-scale targeting of U.S. forces won't be included in the amnesty program. Well, if you only include people in the amnesty program that haven't really committed major acts of violence, there's not much point. The people that are doing this stuff are what's most important. On the other side, if you do include these sorts of people, it would seem to reward this type of behavior. So at the moment, I don't think there's any reason to expect that they're going to be much more effective in the short term at breaking up terrorist cells and terrorist-style activity in the country, though the big hope is that time goes on, more and more Iraqis will be willing to provide intelligence to other Iraqis, people under Alawi, than they were to the Americans. And to be fair, there's some sign that that has started to happen.
This new security law that Alawi wrote himself, some people talk about it as a form of martial law that gave him wider rights to impose curfews and searches and detentions. Are you seeing evidence of that being exercised? Are the police in any way acting more emboldened by that kind of power?
Well, that law gives him the right to declare a state of emergency with the agreement of other parts of this interim government that the Americans cobbled together. He can't do it on his own, and they haven't tried to enact a state of emergency yet. However, there are far more Iraqi police on the streets. They are being far more vigorous and robust in manning spot checkpoints and checking the papers in people's cars. The other day, we got hassled because we have tinted windows to try to protect us as we move around. People can't see we're foreigners. They made us take the tinting off because they want to see inside cars and make sure there's no weapons and so forth. So there was a much more visible Iraqi police presence, and people like that. But we haven't seen any sort of extraordinary powers used yet. But I must say that if they did declare a state of emergency in some areas, that might very well be a very popular thing. Iraqis would be quite delighted with a sort of tougher and more brutal hand in dealing with what they see as the problems of lawlessness and crime inside the country.
Because people would believe that's really the only way to get a handle on it, or because that's more of a return to something a little more familiar, back to the way that Saddam Hussein ruled the country?
Well, it's both, I think. I think it's very interesting. You know, if you talk about American behavior here, nobody would have gotten behind Americans, or very few people would have gotten behind Americans, you know, rounding up alleged criminals and beating them publicly on the street. However, now that Iraqis are in charge, that's exactly the sort of thing that vast numbers of people you talk to want to see. They're delighted that the interim government has reinstated the death penalty for a variety of crimes that was suspended under the Americans. And they really do believe that with the most hostile elements of society, that the best way to deal with them is force. So, you know, that's both the habit of a lifetime, and it's also something that people simply want to see.
Dan, I'm going to stop you there, and we'll continue this when we come back after the break. Just a reminder for our listeners, on the day when a 1,000-pound explosive bomb goes off just outside the Green Zone in Baghdad, we are assessing the ability of the interim Iraqi administration to exercise the security it says it can. I'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The number to join us this hour, 1-800-423-TALK. We are discussing the car bomb that rocked Baghdad this morning, killing a number of people, injuring many more, and raising further questions about the security situation in that city and in that country. Dan Murphy is remaining with us. He is Baghdad correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And we're bringing on Daniel Byman now. Daniel's joining us on the phone from Chevy Chase, Maryland. He's a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution and author of a recent article in The National Interest called In Securing Iraq. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
I'm interested in your sense of this particular moment, whether or not it is up to someone like Mr. Alawi to make the case to Iraqis or to the rest of the world or to Americans that he has the ability to take over control of a country when the Americans stand so closely behind him?
I wouldn't call this a moment, but I would say this is going to be part of a series of events we're going to watch over the next year, which is the transfer of power, however nominal, going to turn into something real? And if it does, do the Iraqis have the capability to impose order? At the moment, they don't, but it's a question of degree. Will their capability increase steadily over the next 6 months as Iraqis see them as legitimate? Or will the government simply be one of many factions in Iraq that has basically an armed militia?
And Daniel, one of the things that you wrote in your article was sort of addressed the importance of getting at crime, not just, you know, the foreign insurgents, but providing the basic security that people need to have the confidence to walk down the street to the market. Dan Murphy was talking about this interim government basically using its muscle to crack down on criminal gangs. And while that may not be specifically connected to the insurgency, I would imagine you'd say that that's a part of the task that they have to show they can do.
Absolutely. Crime and counterinsurgency both are part of the issue of government legitimacy and authority. If people believe the government can protect them, they're likely to turn against criminals. They're likely to inform on potential insurgents. The insurgents aren't necessarily popular because of their violence, but people just have no faith that the government can protect them if people provide intelligence to the government.
And Dan Murphy, in Baghdad, any indication that, you know, just from people that you'll talk to, fixers, translators, people that you're interviewing, that there is more of a will to say, yeah, there is an insurgent down my street?
I think that there's an incredible amount of that. I was talking to a guy who runs a store not far from my hotel the other day, and you know, he has guys in his neighborhood that have been involved in stuff, and he claimed to me that he did indeed call up the Iraqi police shortly after the handover because, you know, he said, I would have felt traitorous to something were I, as a Muslim, informing on other Muslims to the Americans, whose presence here he's incredibly ambivalent about, if not directly hostile to. But he also wants to see this work, and so once the handover came, he felt freed up to inform, and the Interior Ministry claims they're getting a lot of intelligence now that the Americans weren't getting before, and I think there's a fair degree of truth to that.
That's Dan Murphy. He's joining us live from Baghdad, which is why you hear the slightly woolly telephone, but it's great, Dan, to have you with us. Daniel Bimon, we speak of the interim government as an agency that is anxious to take over from the U.S. in providing security. We talk of the insurgents as all bad people, but one of the things that you write about in your article is that there's probably a significant amount of crossover there. Insurgents who are a part of the security forces and working against the government, and that's going to be very difficult for these newcomers to manage.
The diversity or numerous groups within the insurgency is both a curse for Iraq but also a blessing. It'll be exceptionally difficult to defeat the insurgency, in part because I don't think there is a single insurgency. There are numerous groups in Iraq that are opposed to the U.S. occupation and opposed to the current government. Some of them can be defeated. Some of them might be bought off. Some of them might be co-opted. And I think that the new government is taking a reasonable stance in trying to divide these organizations, prevent them from working together, and hopefully weaken the cause overall.
And I can imagine, Dan Murphy, that it wouldn't be a great time to be wandering around Iraq with a Saudi passport or a Syrian passport, that anyone like that could be marked as one of these foreign fighters.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, whilst us people tend to look the same in this region and, you know, they all speak Arabic, and so if you don't speak Arabic, you don't know what they're all about. Around here, a Saudi or a Syrian tends to stick out like a sore thumb to an Iraqi. They have different accents. They dress in different ways. They even look a little bit different to the natives here. And that's one of the things that the local security forces have been saying all along. You know, we know who belongs here and where they belong, and we're going to be able to figure out much more quickly who doesn't. So I'll be surprised if we don't begin to see more of these people arrested in the coming weeks, and that'll be one of the measures of how much success or not this new government is having.
All right, Connection listeners, insider perspectives on what's happening with the security situation in Iraq, specifically on this day and where it's leading us. An opportunity for you to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our first call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Mohammed's on the line. Hi, Mohammed.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have one point. I don't think we're going to see any calm period in Iraq until the general election take place, where the people see that its government is not appointed by anyone else. It's by them, it's elected by them, and it's for them. This is, I think, where we're going to see a calm period. And if I could, I may add one more point, that it's very important not to turn anyone away from, presenting itself as, a leader, because you cannot just, what happened in Algeria, where, one party gets elected and then you turn it down, and stuff like that, and chaos starts happening again.
So when we read stories about the interim prime minister welcoming some of these insurgents to take their place in the political arena, you're saying people need to be sort of large-hearted enough to let those people in?
You see, these insurgents, whatever you call them, it's not – they have the support of the people, some of them. You see what I'm saying? It's not like – 99% of the people, they're not supporting them. If they're not supporting them, they'd be telling about them. So they have some support. And we might see that, behind the scene, those insurgents put someone who could be elected, which is we don't know about yet. It's like the other day you had one guy in the show in NPR, and he turned the job as a prime minister for Iraq.
Let me just ask you one question, though, Mohammed, about the idea of waiting for an election, because if there are, as we are told, and it's one of these things that's very difficult to actually know for certain, but if there are insurgent groups that are working against any kind of independent or democratic attack, you would think that they would be picking up their attacks as we get closer and closer to an election, that an election won't bring any respite from this.
You see, this point, I mean, you could argue this point, but these insurgents, once the people feel that the government is elected government, it's not appointed government, where they went actually to the poll and they elected a certain guy, okay, to be a president for them, I think we will see lots of people reporting about these insurgents, and we is going to calm down, because those people, they have a sense. I don't think they are just, a fool people, just, going, putting bombs everywhere. They have a sense that, they have some support right now. But once the government is elected, I don't think they're going to have any support.
Dan Murphy, I'm not sure how easy it is for you to follow that over a phone line here in this country and all the way to Baghdad. The point that Mohammed's making is that an election should bring an end to the type of violence that we're seeing. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I could hear Mohammed clearly. I think there's no question that only after an election can you hopefully bring an end to this sort of violence, depending on who gets elected and how satisfied various groups in society are. But an election will also bring great dangers, and I wouldn't want to predict one way or another how it's going to go. But I will point out that most of the major political groupings in the country, whether they be the two main Shiite political power parties, Hezbollah Daqwa and Skiri, whether it be the Kurdish groups in the north, or whether it be some of these more hardcore Sunni insurgents in the triangle, all have armed militias. While most of these militias are inactive at the moment, as we get towards political competition, it will be very interesting to see how these militias are used or not used. As will be how those militias are used or not used in the wake of an election. What happens if you have elections and the people that are members of a major insurgency, let's say in the Fallujah, Ramadi, Bakuba area, don't feel that they're well represented in the new government? Will they then turn those guns on the new government, or will they give up and sort of take their marbles and go home? I think it's far too early to say how that's going to play out. But I do agree with this point that the only way we're going to get a government with legitimacy that can begin to work through a lot of the big problems in Iraq is to have an election, and hopefully that will be a credible process that most people will accept. But we're going to have to see how that develops.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Daniel Bima, one of the points that you've made, I'd be interested in hearing from our callers on this one as well, is that it's too early to say that the United States has really found a way of disengaging itself, that part of the security problems that the Iraqis are dealing with now is the fact that the United States never really put enough money into dealing with the security when they were in charge. And in fact, the U.S. may have left too early or made this transfer too early.
To build the security force of another country in a massive way is both extremely expensive and also very time-consuming. If this is going to succeed, it's something that's going to take years, if not more. And, in fact, you could argue it's even hurt to some degree by the current heavy reliance on the United States for security in the country. It's almost a no-win situation where, to take care of the problems of today, you need a large U.S. presence, but that, in turn, decreases the incentives of Iraqis to do the hard work themselves. The only way to get through this really is a long-term commitment to security, but politically, of course, that's exceptionally difficult for the United States, not only because many of the American people are increasingly skeptical about this, but also because U.S. presence is unpopular in Iraq and throughout the world.
So how do you make it work in the next 3 months of an election campaign when the incumbent wants to see as much distance between the American forces and the Iraqi administrators as possible in order to sort of minimize it? Can you have it both ways?
You certainly can't make it succeed in 3 months. What you can do in 3 months is to try to decrease the American face on things. So just as happened recently after an attack, it's Iraqis who are there on the scene. You try to decrease the activity of U.S. forces that might get them shot, so the number of U.S. casualties goes down while the profile of Iraqis goes up. This isn't necessarily the best thing for fighting the insurgency or for improving security, but it is something that can decrease the political presence of the United States in a way that might work for all the various politicians involved.
And Dan Murphy, if I can come back to you in Baghdad, is there any evidence that you see of the American forces pulling back to a level where you see them trying to play or hold a lower profile in events like today's car bomb or even in the regular security and police work that's required in a city the size of Baghdad?
Today was a special case because it was so close to the green zone, or they now call it the multinational zone, where the U.S. Embassy is, where a large number of civilian and sort of military back office staff in the country are still based. So there was a major American response this morning. But a car bombing outside of a hotel 5-6 days ago in the evening, or scratch that, I think it was a mortar, was largely not responded to by the Americans, who let local security forces, local emergency personnel, and the local police respond to it. And certainly in the Baghdad area, we're seeing far fewer Humvees on the roads. The Americans are patrolling a little bit less. When they do patrol, they're trying to patrol with the new Iraqi National Guard. And by and large, that's going to lead to fewer U.S. casualties. Some of the areas around Fallujah and Anbar province are different, where the Marine operations are still quite robust, but in general, there is less American military activity on the roads and highways of Iraq at the moment, and that means that fewer of those soldiers are in harm's way.
1-800-423-TALK to join us next to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine. Question for you, sir.
My thought was this. If we're truly sincere, okay, about establishing a fairly democratic elected government, while the temporary government is in power until January, why can't there be free elections being held immediately on a local, district, citywide area to start the process, okay, to free elections ultimately for, okay, the main government?
Why do you think, Michael, that it'd be any easier to run a municipal election campaign in Baghdad rather than a national election campaign if everybody's concern is who hijacks it? You know what I mean?
First of all, I think it would show the sincerity of the interim government and also the coalition forces that they do intend to have free elections. And second of all, it would give the people an opportunity to express their point of view, and possibly out of these local elections, on a lower level, may come the future leaders of Iraq.
Daniel Beiman, could this work?
You certainly need the local elections as well as the national ones. There are a couple of problems with local elections at the moment. One is that you could have them in much of the country, but that would only highlight the problem in other areas, areas such as Fallujah, where insurgence and violence is strong. There would be a perception that some areas had been liberated in a way and some had not. Another problem is that although elections always seem simple to outsiders, the rules of elections often tend to determine the winners. How you divvy up what a region is, how you divvy up what a city is, often determines who is going to win this. We see the same thing in the United States in battles over electoral boundaries with gerrymandering, for example. And those are things that, frankly, Iraqis need to decide. Because if it's imposed from the United States or others, it'll be seen as the United States is fixing the system. And
Dan Murphy, I think it gets a little bit messier, and I'm basically picking up a point that Daniel Beiman has made here, and that is that if you had these sorts of local elections, you'd get a full slate of Shiite candidates likely winning in the south and a full slate of Kurdish candidates in the north, and miss that opportunity for a sort of federation, which is the overarching notion of what some Iraqis and certainly the Americans want.
That would be one of the risks. I mean, there were many people in the CPA that wanted there to be municipal elections, 6 months ago now, and that idea got nixed. I think that maybe they could have tried it in some cities, and it would have been interesting, as the caller suggests. Other people have now suggested rolling elections for the national elections, choosing to have, elections in the south where it's relatively safer and putting off elections in troubled cities like Kirkuk or in the Sunni Triangle until later. I think that would be a terrible idea because essentially you'd be putting a big X marks the spot on the city you said was safe enough to have elections, and it wouldn't work. And also, as you point out, I do believe it would sort of enhance this disintermediation between these various sectarian and ethnic groups inside Iraq.
1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join our conversation this hour about the delicate matter of trying to transfer power when the insurgency remains as strong and as powerful as it is in Iraq, in Baghdad. Did the United States leave or make this transfer too quickly? Was the United States trying to do it too much on the cheap? Are the Iraqis dealing still with problems left to them by the Americans? Or is this now something for Iraq to manage? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Dan Murphy, Baghdad correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's joining us live from the Iraqi capital. Daniel Beiman is also with us. He's an assistant professor at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and author of a recent article in the National Interest called In Securing Iraq. We are talking to them on this day of the car bomb just outside what we now all refer to as the Green Zone in the center of Baghdad, which houses both the American embassy and the headquarters of the interim Iraqi administration, and trying to make sense of what's happening in that balance between the insurgents and the Iraqis. We're going to go to Boston for our next call, and Hajar is joining us. Did I pronounce your name right?
It's Hajar.
Hajar, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I keep hearing sort of the circular discussion about Iraq, and it sort of feeds into Michael Moore's theory on Fahrenheit 9/11 that the war is going to be ongoing, and just fund the defense industry because the security forces and the U.S. presence in Iraq leads to much more violence and insurgencies and response from all those different groups, and sort of gives them justification. And then at the same time,
okay, so Hajar, if it's a circle that the U.S. presence prompts the violence and the violence forces the U.S. to stay there, and it goes around and around like that, how do you break that?
It sounds like the only way to break that is by not saying we cannot have elections because it's too violent there. There are many places in the world in which their elections were held, in the midst of civil wars, to establish a democratic system and a democratic pattern, and sort of get people thinking about democracy, and with follow through, get people on that track.
All right, let's go to Dan Murphy on this one, because just the very simple question, Dan, of whether or not that choice is something that Iraqis have. If Alawi and company said, yeah, we can get our elections underway. In fact, the campaign might be the best thing for the country. Could they go earlier rather than later? Most people have been saying they won't even make the deadline they're living with.
Well, it depends what kind of elections you want to have. The way things are now, none of the preparatory work, getting down to censuses and determining what fair districts are, have been done. Of course, the plan for the election now is for a single district. And the idea would be is that they would basically everybody in the country from the far north to the far south would all be in one big district, and you'd need about 20 or 30,000 votes for you to get elected. And so perhaps that could happen sooner. People talked months ago about using food ration cards to get people set up to vote. But the bigger issue, and it was touched on by Mr. Feynman a few minutes ago, was that they haven't set the rules of the game yet. And setting those rules of the game will probably have a very important effects on the outcome. If you're not careful in drawing up these rules, the eventual losers, rightly or wrongly, fairly or unfairly, are going to say that they got gypped. They weren't given a fair chance, and that could lead to more violence and instability here. So there's probably a strong argument to be made to do it a little bit more slowly at this point, but to do it right.
To Nashville, Tennessee next, and Roland's with us. Hi, Roland.
Hi, I'm a mediator with a program called Mediation Works, and one of the things that I've noticed during this whole process is really the coalition not really listening very much to the Iraqis, and I think that what we really need to do is ask them by an election to decide whether they want to have us there or not, and one way to do that would be to acknowledge that the country is divided up into three major religions and have a second house of the legislature that is, let the Sunnis decide on three, I mean 10.
Okay, let's not just go into the construction of the parliament,
right,
or a Congress for a minute. The idea of a referendum on should Americans remain in the country or not. I mean, as a mediator, Roland, you'd want to be able to guarantee to anyone who was casting a vote that they could get to the ballot box, that their vote would count. In a country that's so upside down, could you do that today?
You're talking, yes. The thing is that anybody with a voter's card is automatically a target at the moment. But one way that we can get past that is the religions all know who's in their mosque or whatever. And if we had an election amongst the religions to, like, each one present like a third of the cabinet, a third of the legislature, with some extra votes for the smaller groups, they could decide that in 10 days. They could come up with 10 people from each of the major religions and let them decide, have a referendum immediately
okay.
after that.
Daniel Byman, doesn't this go back to a form of the Iraqi Governing Council where they tried to create this kind of religious or sectarian balance in the country?
Absolutely. The problem with Iraq is the boundary lines aren't neat. The caller alluded to three religions. In a way, there are more religions, in a way, there are fewer. People tend to think of three main groups, but these groups actually aren't all religious. One of the main groups is Kurdish, which is ethno-linguistic. And not to get bogged down in details, but the problem is some people belong to multiple groups, and within the groups, it's unclear who should be the leader of that group. To make a U.S. comparison, if you had a group called Protestants, would the leaders be Baptists or Presbyterians? And you'd have a huge fight if you said, we're just going to give it to the Protestants without specifying that. The same is true with Iraq. There are divisions within divisions. And whenever you try to come up with a grand bargain like this, these divisions come to the fore and make it extremely complex.
And I can't help but think, Dan Murphy, that every time we turn our attention to this and talk about what the situation looks like and what the options are, that
and fair enough, but not for the Iraqis. We end up envisaging American solutions for a problem that's not really very similar.
Well, just getting back to the caller's point, something similar was tried in Lebanon a generation ago, and it was a viciously brutal failure. I think it would be a very bad idea, and as Mr. Feynman again pointed out, there are incredible divisions even within the Shia community, within the Sunni community, in terms of what it means to be a Shia or a Sunni. Iraq is going to need Iraqi solutions. The problem is, in the current environment, it's not peaceful enough for Iraqis of goodwill to sit down and really start to hash this stuff out without enormous risks to their lives. So unfortunately, America is sort of trapped into this mediating role, whereas it's hard for us to, you know, be seen as acting in good faith because of the tremendous amount of suspicions that average Iraqis have towards U.S. intentions. I don't think it's a really good idea to disengage entirely at this point and sort of let these factions fight it out amongst themselves.
To Buffalo, New York. Next, Lou's joining us. Hi, Lou.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the insurgents, I got to, you know, discuss with your first caller. He talked about with the elections allowing the insurgents to start getting involved and being allowed to be involved in
well, I think what Mohammed was saying principally was that the act of holding the election itself would be a quicker move to an end to the violence, right?
Well, I don't know that they would be a quicker end to violence. I mean, these are people bent on violence and destruction and upsetting the process to begin with, because I think they're more motivated by their own personal, you know, their own personal gains kind of thing. I don't think the election or the democratic process is of a concern to them at all, other than it's not part of their culture and they want to be totally disruptive with it. That I don't think they're ever going to be amalgamated or part of the process. I don't think they have any intention of it. That's why they're bent and continue to be bent on the destruction that you see day in and day out.
So, Lou, you're going nowhere until you crack down on those people.
Exactly. Yes. That's why I feel Alawi has to. I mean, even if it takes a time where he's involved with martial law, I feel that he has to take strong steps to address it and stifle it. Yes.
We come back to some part of the conversation that we had earlier in the hour, and Dan Murphy, I'm going to start with you on this and then go to Daniel Beimer, but this is the idea that crime is as much of a problem as the insurgency. I mean, I know from talking to people in that city how worried they are about kidnapping and various other kinds of criminal activities like that. If Alawi does concentrate on the criminals, as you said he was at the beginning of the program, is that perhaps the proper first step to getting at the really bad eggs here?
I think it's a proper first step in building credibility for his government and making Iraqis feel safer in their homes. You know, the vast majority of Iraqis that have suffered since the occupation began have done so at the hands of you know, what we would call criminals, as opposed to people with a political agenda. You know, they're quite happy to have Fallujah set aside for the moment, as one example. And if they can see cops out busting heads on what they imagine to be bad elements, I think it's very, very helpful. But I think as we go forward, you know, if we have these pockets of the country outside of formal national control, that is certainly real trouble down the road. And so it becomes a dilemma as we get closer to January, assuming the elections stay on track, as to what sorts of action will be taken to pacify and neutralize people in those sorts of areas.
And Daniel Beimer, one of the things that you wrote about was, if I got your words right, a change of culture being required even for the police and the security forces. What are you talking about there?
Well, when we think of police in the United States, we have a very definite image of people who, in general, uphold law and order. In Iraq, the police were something quite different. They were upholding the regime for the most part, and you didn't have a culture of respect for the rule of law. Corruption was ripe, and politics were ripe in policing. What you need now is a police force that in some way stands above government, that doesn't matter who's in power in Baghdad, you can always turn to the police if there's a crime. And that's an exceptionally difficult culture to create. It sounds very straightforward, but requires a degree of trusting strangers. It requires that the police are paid enough money so they don't naturally turn to corruption. And, again, it requires a lot of time because you have to weed out people who have been in the system for decades in many cases.
But how do you get there? I mean, how do you start?
Starting is exceptionally hard. You start by having very strict control over promotion. You have a lot of training at a junior level, so people at least know what the right thing to do is, and you have constant vigilance and monitoring. But all this is very easy to say and exceptionally difficult to do.
And are Iraqis supposed to do this with their own security force, or is this better done with international involvement?
Policing is almost always better done by locals. They know the communities, and they don't automatically generate resentment as outsiders would do. But the training for this and perhaps some supervision of promotion would benefit from outside help. It doesn't have to be American. There are many European states or Asian states that also would do an excellent job. But installing these standards is something that I think needs a lot of people helping.
Dan Murphy, does that jive with what you've actually been seeing on the street, the need to make this shift?
It needed to be made. I met with the Minister of Interior about 4 or 5 days ago, and I said I'd like to go out, you know, on some raids with some of your new guys and see what they're doing. And he said, look, we can't let you do that right now. Too many of these guys are corrupt. They're violating our own rules, and it would be embarrassing to us for you to see this. He said, please give us time, and we're gonna start to get our arms around this, and their performance is going to dramatically improve. In the end, you know, Americans can provide training and guidance and so forth, but these are always questions of political will and whether or not both the government can deliver on what it's saying it's going to do and will deliver remains to be seen, because they need large numbers of police on the streets right now. And I think if you began massive purges, you could contribute to the short-term problem. So it's a very devilish problem to deal with.
Okay. Dan Murphy, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Dan is Baghdad correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Daniel Byman, it was good of you to join us as well. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Daniel Byman is assistant professor at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Earlier in the program, we had a chance to hear from Peter Gresty, Baghdad correspondent for the BBC. Our program is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Micah Sieber and Nadia Osayev. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.